General Organic Biochemistry, a survey. The language of chemistry. Why do we need scientific notation? And okay, how do I determine the right number of significant digits that I should use? Well, why do we need the metric system? Hasn't the English system been working a whole lot longer than the metric system and is very successful? Why is 32 degrees Fahrenheit set as the freezing point of water, but it's zero on the Celsius scale? And what is the difference between inorganic and organic compounds? There are some terms that we're going to need to have as part of our vocabulary in this course. For example, hypothesis. You feel ill, you go to the doctor with a certain set of symptoms, and without doing any tests or anything, the physician certainly makes an educated guess. Of course, this may be proven or disproven by subsequent tests, but initially, that is a hypothesis. Then there is theory. Now, a theory is a hypothesis that has been tested again and again and again, and it seems to explain certain behavior or actions. For example, there is atomic theory, which we think explains how certain atoms behave. Law is a tested proposal that applies to many circumstances. It is a proposal that has been tested out by putting it in a number of different circumstances, and it seems to hold true each time. You will hear us refer to Dalton's Law of Partial Pressures, among others. Inorganic compounds are non-carbon-based compounds. They are compounds that have other elements: iron, oxygen, nitrogen, zinc, potassium, sodium, on and on and on and on. Organic compounds, however, are carbon-based. Granted, they may contain nitrogen or oxygen or phosphorus or sulfur or things of that type, but they always contain carbon. Carbon-based compounds. Matter and energy. Do you think you know what matter is? Well, you very possibly do. Matter is anything that has mass and occupies space. There are, for all practical purposes, and certainly for our purposes, three states of matter. There are solids, liquids, and gases. But you probably already knew that, didn't you? Let's start with solids. Solids are anything that has a definite shape and a definite volume. You can take a solid material and set it down and expect it to maintain its shape and maintain its volume without getting soft and running off the table or whatever you happen to have it placed upon. Liquids. What are liquids? Well, liquids are anything that has a definite volume but happens to take the shape of its container. It has a definite volume, but it happens to take the shape of its container. And what about gases? Well, gases are anything that take both the volume and the shape of the container. Both the volume and the shape. Can everything be classified as either a solid, a liquid, or a gas? Well, what about glass? What about plastics? Yeah. These materials have properties of both liquids and solids because they tend to soften when they're heated rather than melt. And as a matter of fact, some of the very, very, very old glass that you see in some of the churches, the original glass that you see in some of the ancient churches in Europe, you will notice the glass is thinner at the top than it is at the bottom. So it does tend to flow a little bit, but enough to make it a liquid? Well, these materials that tend to soften when they're heated rather than melt sharply at a definite temperature are said to be amorphous solids. Oh well, let's go on. Physical and chemical changes. Let's start with physical changes. Physical changes are changes among the three states of matter as a rule. For example, a liquid may change to a gas. Sure, by boiling or evaporation, that is a physical change. It doesn't change the nature of the material. A gas may condense to a liquid, or a gas could condense to a solid. Sure, it could do that. But again, the chemical characteristics of the compound or element that you're using hasn't changed. So we're talking about a change in the state of matter, but not about a change in the inherent nature of the material itself. Or a solid could melt, or a solid could sublime. Sublime, you know what that is. That's conversion to a gas. You set mothballs out, and they evaporate, but they're a solid, and they're going to a gas. They are said to be subliming, or carbon dioxide solid sublimes as it converts to a gas. These are physical changes. Now, let's talk about chemical changes. A chemical change is quite different from a physical change. It is a change that produces a new substance with a new set of physical and chemical properties. Something reacts. A chemical reaction has occurred, which means that the nature of the material itself has changed, and a new set of properties, physical and chemical, has evolved. For example, milk turns sour, or iron rusts, or how about fireworks? Yeah, that's an example of a chemical change. Now that we've talked about physical and chemical changes, let's talk about physical and chemical properties. And we'll begin with physical properties. Now, physical properties are properties that describe things without involving a change in the substance, without involving a reaction. For example, talk about the color something may have. Is it blue or green or white or clear? The state of matter. Is it solid, liquid, gas, amorphous? Just what is it there? Its melting point. And is its melting point sharp and well-defined, or does it actually soften rather than melt? Its boiling point. This is a physical property, too. And what about its odor? Yes, physical properties. Chemical properties, on the other hand, usually involve the reactions that something may undergo. For example, you may have something that will burn or explode. Or maybe it reacts with acids. Or perhaps if you heat it, it gives off a gas. Or maybe if you drop it or strike it, it will explode. These are chemical properties. And they involve changes in something. Now let's talk about matter and energy for a moment, but let's begin with energy. How would you describe energy? If you've had right much science in your background, you probably know that energy is the ability to do work, or if you will, it's the ability to transfer heat. There are two forms of energy. The two forms of energy are potential energy and kinetic energy. Let's start with potential energy. Potential energy is stored energy. It's energy that's ready to be used. Sometimes it's called energy of position, stored energy, or energy of position. And then there's kinetic energy, which is energy in motion. When something is moving, or when energy is being used, that is kinetic energy. Now here's an example I like to use, if you will. It's been a long, hard, hot day, and you decided to go play a round of golf. Well, let me tell you, it was a mistake, because your golf game was not at its best today. So you come up to the caddy shack, and you stand your golf clubs up there, and you go stomping off to get something cold to drink. But you happened to leave the golf club standing on a precipice by the Caddyshack. And, oh, you get more and more and more aggravated the more you think about it, and you come back and you give those clubs a good, swift kick. Now, where they're standing now, they have potential energy. But you kick them and, oh, off they go, kinetic energy. Yes, oops, they landed in the pond. Well, you have a decision to make. Are you going to fish, or are you just going to pack it up and go home? Let's look at the units of energy. There are three practical units of energy. There's the calorie, or the joule, or the BTU. The BTU stands for British Thermal Unit. But we're not going to use BTUs in this class. What we generally use are calories or joules. So, there's an exchange you need to know, and this is important. Put this on one of your flashcards. On one side, put 4.184 joules, and on the other side, put 1.000 calories. Because 4.184 joules is the same as one calorie. And learn that, folks. Don't fail to do that. Are you ready to talk about measurements? I know it seems like we're jumping around an awful lot as we go from one topic to the other, trying to lay a foundation, but you might be able to keep track of things by looking over on the left-hand side of your screen and seeing where we are in the unit called the language of chemistry. All right, under measurements, we're going to consider the English system, which of course is a system that if you were born in America and grew up here, you probably used from day one. But we're going to also talk about the very important metric system. And in the process of all of this, we are going to introduce the concept of scientific notation. So folks, go find your calculator, because you're going to need it. Let's begin with the English system. Are you ready? Now, in the English system, we talk about length in terms of inches, or foot, or mile, or yards, or rod, or something along that line. And weight is a term for the English system. And it is in ounces, or pounds, or things of this type. For volume, we use teaspoons, quarts, gallons, cups, tablespoons, pints, and things of this type. It's a really good idea for you to visit a cookbook, especially so you can make sure you have a handle on the units of volume, because there are a number of them, and you need to know some of the relationships among these units of volume in the English system. And I have to wonder, how much do you really know about the English system? Well, for example, how many inches are in 2.86 yards? Oh, piece of cake, you say. Just take 2.86 and multiply it by 36. But I want to lay this problem out for you in such a way that you will see a way to show me that you understand and know what you're doing. You start with 2.86 yards, and you multiply that by 36 inches per yard. And you will notice that yards will cancel. And when they cancel, you will come out with 102.96 inches. Now, folks, you really aren't justified in using all those digits, but we'll talk about that a little later. How many teaspoons are in 2.9 pints? Whoa, you say, wait a minute. Pints to teaspoons? Well, I know I can take 2.9 pints, and I know that there are two cups and a pint, but where do I go from there? Well, folks, it's something you should know. The pints are going to cancel, and then we're going to multiply that by 16 tablespoons per cup. You need to know there are 16 tablespoons in a cup. It's a handy thing to know in the kitchen. And cups are going to cancel. Now we can go from tablespoons to teaspoons. How many teaspoons are in a tablespoon? Do you know? Well, In case you're not sure, there are 3 teaspoons and a tablespoon. Yes. And tablespoons are now going to cancel, and the only unit we have left is teaspoons, which is what we want. So we take our 2.9 and multiply it by 2 and multiply it by 16 and multiply it by 3, and that's going to give us 278.4 teaspoons. Yeah. And that's our answer. Again, we'll talk about the significant digits later. Now, the metric system. The metric system, we also have length and mass and volume. Now, length in the metric system, the unit or the basic unit of length is the meter. And mass, in the metric system, we refer to it as mass. In the English system, we refer to, when we're talking about such things, we talk about it as weight. Technically, weight is English and mass is metric, but quite often we mix them up. But anyway, the unit of mass in the metric system is the gram. And the unit of volume in the metric system, why, that's the liter. Let's start with length. How long is a meter? Well, a meter is a little over 39 inches. If you take a yardstick and a meter stick and you compare them, you'll see that a meter stick is a little longer than a yardstick. That's right, a little longer. Actually, it's just a little over 39 inches for a meter, and it's exactly 36 inches for a yard. Mass, or weight, it has a basic unit of grams. Now, just how big is a gram? Have you ever seen an old, thin silver dime that's been worn thin? Yeah, that's about a gram. It's about like an old, thin silver dime. The volume of a liter? Well, a liter is just a little bit larger than a quart. Yes, a liter is a little larger than a quart. Now let's talk about the prefixes of the metric system. You have to learn these. You have to know them. The meter, the gram, the liter, the basic units of length, and mass and volume. If you have 1,000 of any of them, for example, 1,000 meters, you have a kilometer or a kilometer. 1,000 grams is a kilogram. 1,000 liters is a kiloliter. Okay, very easy. Now let's look at a tenth. A tenth of a meter is a decimeter. A tenth of a gram is a decigram. A tenth of a liter is a deciliter. Yeah. A hundredth of a meter is a centimeter. A hundredth of a gram is a centigram. A hundredth of a liter is a centiliter. And a thousandth? Well, a thousandth of a meter is a millimeter, of a gram is a milligram, and of a liter is a milliliter. And there are many other prefixes, but these are the ones we want you to know. But folks, missing a cookbook won't help, but oh, let me tell you something. You know the metric system because you know how to spend money. That's right. Let's look at the prefixes of the monetary system. The basic unit of our monetary system is the dollar, established by Thomas Jefferson. $1,000, well, we'll compare the dollar and the gram. That's the best way to do it. $1,000 is a grand. Well, we don't use that term very often. 1,000 grams is a kilogram. Okay. A tenth of a dollar is a dime. A tenth of a gram is a decigram. D and D, dime and decigram. A hundredth of a dollar is a cent or a penny. A cent or a penny. A hundredth of a gram is a centigram. See how it works? A thousandth of a dollar. A thousandth of a dollar? You say, I don't use a thousandth of a dollar. Oh, yes, you do, you taxpayers. A thousandth of a dollar is a mil. A thousandth of a gram is a milligram. So you can spend money, so you can do metrics. Let's try a problem. How about it? How many centimeters are in 0.0023 kilometers or kilometers? Well, we start with our 0.0023 kilometers. And let's see, let's convert our kilometers to meters. How's that? We know there are 1,000 meters in a kilometer. Yeah. Okay, so now our kilometers cancel and we're at meters. So where do we go from here? We go to centimeters. And how many centimeters are in a meter? Well, there are 100 centimeters in a meter. So meters cancel. And 0.0023 times 1,000 times 100 is going to give us 230 centimeters. See how that goes? Use the metrics to help. Use the monetary system to help you remember your metric relationships. There are some conversions from English to metric and metric to English that you really need to know. So put these on flashcards and learn them. 2.54 centimeters is exactly an inch. So 2.54 centimeters or 2.54000000 centimeters is equal to precisely 1 inch, 1.000, as many places as you want to carry it. Now there are approximately 454 grams in a pound. Approximately 454 grams in a pound. And there are approximately 946 milliliters in a quart. Approximately 946 milliliters in a quart. Now learn these, folks. This will give you a way of knowing about what size things are when we talk about them in the metric system. Here's a good problem for us to try. How many pounds are in 86 kilograms? Now you've got to remember your conversion in between mass and weight in the metric system. And your conversion is that there are 454 grams in a pound. So what we've got to do is find out how many pounds are in 86 kilograms. So what we need to convert is 86 kilograms to grams, and then we can go from grams to pound. Watch. Now you have to remember, 454 grams is equal to a pound. That is our pivotal point in this calculation. So we start out with 86 kilograms, and we multiply it by 1,000 grams per kilogram. Now our kilograms cancel. And when they cancel, what unit does this leave us with? That's right, it leaves us with grams. Now let's go from grams to pounds. Well, we know that there are in 1 pound 454 kilograms. So grams will cancel. Now folks, you cancel the things on the top with the things on the bottom. You can't cancel two things on the bottom on the same side, so don't even try. And you take 86 and you multiply it by 1,000 and you divide that by 454, and I got 189.4273 pounds. Folks, you can't use all those numbers, but that's okay for right now. We'll explain how many to use when we talk about significant digits, which is a little bit further down the road. But remember, the key to this particular problem was 454 grams is equal to a pound. Now under measurements, let's talk about scientific notation. What is scientific notation, and why do we even need it? Well, scientific notation is a way of writing really large or really small numbers, monster numbers on either end of the scale. By replacing some digit space and zeros with an exponent. And the reason we need to do this is what I said before. Some numbers just are monsters. Look, here's a number. Man, that's a big number. You don't want to have to write that 20 times. You'll forget surely how many zeros to have in there, and then you'll have the number all screwed up. It's so much easier to remember it as 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd power. See? Well, look at this very, very small number. Oh, what would happen if you had to write that 4 times? Would you get the number of zeros right? Probably not. But using scientific notation, it becomes 4.52 times 10 to the negative 10th. Here, let me show you how it works. Let's look at this number again. Now, where's the decimal point? Well, the decimal point is understood to be down here at the end. Yeah, and I made the decimal point big so it would stand out, and I made it fly in so it would catch your attention. But what we've got to do now is move that decimal point all the way down to the left so that there's only one number to the left of the decimal. In other words, we've got to move that decimal down to between the 0 and the 6. Now, as we move it, count the decimal places. We move it down here between the 6 and the 0, and the number becomes, did you count the decimal places? Let's count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23. And the number then becomes 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. Do you see how that worked? Yes. Now notice the sign on the exponent. The sign on the exponent is an understood plus sign. And what does that mean? Well, that means that that number was much larger than 0, and we had to move the decimal to the left to make that number become written in a manageable form. Let's go on. Consider this little tiny number. Yeah, now you see where its decimal is, and we want the decimal to wind up being between 5 and 6. So move the decimal and count the places. You ready? There it goes. How many places did you move it? We moved it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 places, didn't you? So the number becomes 5.62 times 10 to the negative 6. Look, folks, let's get it straight. If you have a little bitty number and you move the decimal point to the right, you use a negative exponent. If you have a great big number and you move the decimal point to the left, you have a positive exponent. And we don't generally write a plus in front of it, but you can. Now, I need to be quiet and let you write that down. Let me say it again for you so we can be sure. If you move the decimal to the right, you have a negative exponent. If you move the decimal to the left, you have a positive exponent. Got that? Okay. Let's try some practice ones. As an example, let's use 0.00763. And what we do with this now is we want to have this decimal right here move over and be at this position because our number should come out to be 7.63. But now we have to show a way to tell us how many places we moved that decimal in order to achieve this. And what we do is we count. We moved it 1, 2, 3 places to the right. So this is 7.63 times 10 to the negative 3. The negative 3 indicates that we moved it to the right. that the number was in fact smaller than 1. Let's try another one. How about 0.000064? Now, what would you do with this one? Well, remember now, you want the decimal to be, you want there to be one place to the left of the decimal. So it should be 6.4 times 10 to the, you start your decimal here, and you're going to move it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 places, but you're moving those to the right, so it's 6.4 times 10 to the negative 5th. Now, look at this. Suppose we gave you this number. This number is definitely larger than 1, and there's an understood decimal right here. We want to move this decimal back 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 places. And this number then will become 2.4 times 10 to the... But how do we designate it? We move the decimal to the left. And if we move the decimal to the left, we use a positive exponent. So this becomes 2.4 times 10 to the 5th power. Do you get the idea? Let's let you try one. Suppose I give you 7 with a number of zeros after it. What is this going to be? Stop the video if you need to and try your hand at it, then start the video up again. And let's see what I put. I put 7 times 10 to the, and I know it's going to be a positive exponent. It's going to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 places. So it's 7 times 10 to the 5th power. Did you get that? All right, try your hand at this one. 0.000394. What's that going to be? Now keep track of which way you're moving your decimal. Stop the video, try it out, and then start the video when you're ready to see what I have. I have 3.94 times 10 to the negative, remember? And I'm moving that decimal 1, 2, 3, 4 places. So it's times 10 to the negative 4. Do you understand what's going on? Do you have a handle on it? I certainly hope so. We're ready now to look at significant figures or significant digits. But let's take just a moment and sidestep for a second and look at a couple of terms. We need to also look at accuracy. And we need to look at precision. What is accuracy? Well, accuracy is how nearly correct a value, or possibly a group of values, happens to be. While precision is how close measurement values are to each other. You can be accurate without being precise. You can be precise without being accurate. You can be both inaccurate and not precise. You can be both precise and accurate. What is best? Of course, both accurate and precise. Let me show you something that might help you to see what I'm talking about. Look at this data right here. Now, this data right here, see, we've got a dart in the gold area, one in the blue area, and one in the green area. That stuff is inaccurate. It's inaccurate. There's not much agreement there. Accuracy, in this case, is landing in the bullseye, isn't it? So these are really very inaccurate. All right, now look at this. Oh, all of these are the same. They're in the same area. They may not be accurate, but oh, they are precise, aren't they? Because they're very close to each other. That's right, they're very close. The ones up on top were not precise, were they? They weren't particularly close to each other. Now let's look down here at this next one. Look at these. They're all in the bullseye. They are accurate and they are precise. And of course, accurate and precise is what we look for. But you need to know that sometimes you can be one without being the other. Okay. significant figures. There are a series of rules that you need to learn for determining significant figures. Are you ready? Let's write them down. If you write them down, you may remember them better. All non-zero numbers are significant. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, they're all significant. Okay? All counting numbers are significant. Suppose you're going to count to 11. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. The 0 in that 10 is significant because it's a counting number in this case. All zeros that come between significant figures are significant. If there are zeros between significant figures, those zeros are significant, and they are called captive zeros. All zeros that come before significant figures are not significant. They come between them, they are significant. If they come before them, they are not significant. Let me give you an example. Look at this 0.003402. Now look at these right here. See these three digits, these three zeros? Well, these three zeros are not significant. But what about this zero right here? It's between two significant figures, right? So it is significant. Yeah. Get these rules down. I'll stop for a minute and let you finish writing, and then we'll go on. You may have to back this section up and play it several times in order to get all this information. All right, let's move on. Here are two more rules. Trailing zeros are only significant if a decimal point is actually present. Kind of like this. Now look, here's 1200, and you and I both know that there's an understood decimal point at the end of this, but you don't see it, do you? Therefore, we don't say with certainty that the decimal point is present. This one has two significant digits because those two zeros, those trailing zeros, are not significant. But look at this. Here we have a decimal point. This tells us that this was measured accurately out this far. So, this one has four significant digits, a 1, a 2, and 2 zeros. Now, what about this? It has four trailing zeros. Are they significant? Yes, they're significant. So how many significant figures are in this number? And the answer is there are six. Okay, another rule. Absolute equalities are significant. Look, you know there are 10 dimes in a dollar. They're 10 dimes. That is absolute. Those are absolutely equal. So that zero is significant there. Yes, as far if you what if you had how many nickels were in a dollar? That would be 20, wouldn't it? Yeah. What about 2.54 centimeters equals 1 inch? Yes, that's an absolute equality. So all of those digits are significant. What about 1,000 meters equals a kilometer? I know we don't have the decimal there, but that's an absolute equality. So all of those digits are significant. Get the rules down. Now, how do we apply this to problems? Let me show you. For multiplication and division, are you ready? Whenever we're multiplying and dividing, the answer should have the same number of significant digits as the quantity with the least number of significant digits. Let me show you. Suppose we have 6.32 times 5.1. Now 6.32 has three significant digits. 5.1 has two significant digits. When we multiply the two of them, we get the answer 32.2320. How many significant digits can we use? Well, look at the problem. The problem has a 3-significant-digit figure and a 2-significant-digit figure. Therefore, we are only allowed to use how many? That's right, we're only allowed to use 2 significant figures here. 2, because the 5.1 has the lesser number of significant figures. The answer should have the same number of significant figures as the quantity with the least number of significant figures. Okay. For addition and subtraction, however, the answer should have the same number of decimal places as the number with the least number of decimal places. And we're talking about places beyond the decimal. Talking about the number of places beyond the decimal. For example, suppose we take 6.32, which has 2 places to the right of the decimal, or 2 places beyond the decimal, plus 5.1, which has 1 place beyond the decimal, plus 22, which has no places beyond the decimal. We add these up and we get 33.42. But what should the answer be? Well, the one that has the least number of decimal places beyond the decimal, or the least number of decimal places to the right of the decimal, is a 22. It doesn't have any. Therefore, the answer should be 33, because 22 has no places beyond the decimal. You'll get the idea. Just keep trucking. Now, let's talk about rounding off numbers. It's really easy. If the first number to be dropped is 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4, well, just drop all the remaining numbers. For example, suppose I were to ask you to round 4.84932 to 2 places. In other words, I want you to round it to 4 point something. Well, it's apparent that we're going to have to drop the 4 that follows the 8. Does that 4 make the 8 round up? Or does that 4 leave the 8 alone? And the rule says if the first number, that's the one closest in there, the first number to be dropped is 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4, just drop everything. So the answer is 4.8. You got it? It's 4.8 because we had to drop 4.932. And the first number that we had to drop was a 4. So that's why we just chunked them all out. If the first number to be dropped is 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9, why, you round the preceding number up. For example, suppose I ask you to round 4.84932 to 3 places. It can be 4.84. Or is it going to be 4.85? Well, the first number that we're going to drop, we're going to drop the 932. And the first number is 9. So that makes the 4 round up. So the answer is 4.85. Got the idea? Good. Try these. Round 794.55 to 4 places. Got it? Here's your answer. 794.6. Yeah. The 5 made the preceding 5 round up. What about rounding 3495 to 2 places? We're going to keep the 3. The question is, does the 4 round up or does it stay as 4? And the answer is, it rounds up. So we come up with the answer of 3500. We have rounded it to 2 places. That's right. We'll round 3495 to 3 places. We're going to keep the 3, 4. Are we going to keep the 9 or drop it? Well, the number to be dropped is going to be a 5. We've got the 3, 4, and the 9. Do we keep the 9 or do we round it up? I'm going to say it right in a minute. Well, we have to look at the 5. The 5 says we round the 9 up. So we drop the 5, we round the 9 up, and we come up to 3500. And I put the decimal there so you would know that that 3500 was certainly significant. Okay. Yep. It's actually 4 places I know, but there wasn't much other way to do it. Problem solving. How do you solve problems? Students have asked me this from day one of teaching. How do you go about solving problems? Well, you start with what you're given. Note what you are given and make a note of the unit that you want to have at the end of your problem. That's really important because that points you in the direction. Set up your factors so that they will cancel, so that the units will cancel. And then when you get done working everything out and doing your multiplying and dividing and adding and subtracting, then round off as you need to get the right number of significant figures. Got it? Okay. Do you remember this problem? Let me show you. How many pounds are in 86 kilograms? Well, remember 454 grams equals 1.00 pounds? Yeah. Okay. So we started with 86 kilograms times 100 grams per kilogram, and our kilograms canceled. Don't you start rounding off yet. You wait until you're through to round off. Times 1 pound per 454 grams. And we worked it out, and we came out after we canceled our grams with 189.4273 pounds. And I told you then, we can't use all those numbers. Now, how many significant figures are we justified in using? Well, look at the 86. It has how many? It has 2. Now, look at the 1,000 grams per kilogram. That's an absolute equality. So all of those 1,000, all 4 of those are significant. Now, the 1 pound per 454 grams. That is approximate. So you've got 3 significant digits on top and 3 significant digits on the bottom. So it looks to me like the least number of significant digits that we have is 2. So how many figures are we justified in using? 2. And what is our answer when we have rounded off? Rounded off now to 2 significant figures. And the answer is 190 pounds. That's right. Make sure you can do that. Let's try this one. How many grams are in 1.05 ounces? Grams and ounces. Oh my goodness. The only conversion I know to grams from weight, which is the English system, is 454 grams in a pound. So I guess I better get 1.05 ounces over to pounds, and then from pounds to grams. Make sense? Got to have a focal point here. So I'm going to, remember, 454 grams is a pound. So I start with my 1.05 ounces, and I multiply that by 1 pound per 16 ounces. Now that's absolute equality. That 1 pound could just as, you could list it as 1.0 pounds, because you've got 16 ounces per pound. That is significant to as many digits as you want to take it. So don't use that in your determination of significant digits. Ounces cancel. 454 grams and a pound. Well, 454 grams, that's 3 significant digits. And that's 1.00 pounds, if you will, or just don't worry about the pounds. Work that out, and it comes out to be 29.7938 grams. But we can't use all those numbers. So how many significant figures are we justified in using? Well, the 1.05 has 3. The 454 grams has 3. I think we're justified in using 3 significant figures. So when we round that off, let's see, we've got, look at that 7. Does the 9 make it round up? The answer is yes. So the answer is 29.8 grams. Got the idea? What is temperature? Well, it's actually relative hotness and coldness. Relative? Relative to what? Well, whatever. But one thing you've got to understand, or one thing you've got to accept, is temperature is not a measure of heat. It's not a measure of heat. It may be a way of being able to determine whether or not something feels warmer than something else, but it is not a measure of heat. Are you confused? Well, let's look at 3 scales, but let's also look at the way one of them was developed. In early 1700s, around 1724, Daniel Auguste Fahrenheit published an article about a new thermometer he had invented. He was trying to do some research on reactions over a broad range of temperatures, and in that day and time, the thermometers they had were alcohol thermometers that had a very narrow range. Too cold, they'd freeze. Too hot, they'd boil and blow the top out of the thermometer. So he decided he needed a thermometer that could extend over a broad range of temperatures. So he decided the mercury thermometer was the thing to use. So he designed and built a mercury thermometer. Now he's got this mercury thermometer, and oh, it has quite a range. But where is he going to start his temperature scale? Well, he decided he needed to start his temperature scale at 0, but that needed to be about the coldest anything could get. So he took a page from the Danish astronomer Romer, who said nothing could possibly be colder than the coldest day in Denmark. And so Fahrenheit put his thermometer out, and on the coldest day they had, he noted noted the place on the thermometer, and he marked it. And that he allowed to be 0. Okay, he's got his first point on his thermometer. What is he going to use for his next point? He thought about using the freezing point of pure water. Now, he knew that everybody said that water froze at a variety of temperatures, depending on the ambient conditions, or depending on a variety of factors. But he decided to check that out. So he took his thermometer, and he tested the freezing point of pure water, and he marked it. And he did it again, and again, and again, and again, and found, much to his surprise, and to the surprise of his fellow scientists, that pure water always froze at the same point. So here he has his 0 mark, and here he has another line, which is the freezing point of water. How many units shall he make between those? Well, he wanted to make a lot of units between them that could be divisible by a lot of numbers. So he chose 2 to the 5th power. 2 to the 5th power. That's 2 times 2 is 4, times 2 is 8, times 2 is 16, times 2 is 32. And so he marked the freezing point of pure water as 32. Well, he needed another point. So he started thinking, He put the thermometer in his mouth, marked that temperature. Put it in his wife's mouth, marked that, same temperature. Put it under his arm, marked that, same spot. Put it under her arm, same temperature. So he noticed that between his 0 and his 32 was this much space, but between the 32 and the freezing point
or rather body temperature, was about twice as much space. So he said, okay, this is 32 units, this is 64 units, making it a total of 96 units from zero to body temperature. So he set body temperature as 96 degrees. Now, since then, his thermometer has been tweaked a little bit. The zero and the 32 are still, those are good. The body temperature has changed just a little. And it's the consensus now that average body temperature is about 98.6. But isn't it fascinating the way the thermometer and the temperature scale came about?
The temperature scales that we are interested in are the Fahrenheit scale, learn how to spell that, the Celsius scale, and the Kelvin scale. Now, let's see what happens to water. Water boils. What temperature does water boil on the Fahrenheit scale? Yeah, 212 degrees Fahrenheit. And on the Celsius scale, it boils at 100 degrees. On the Kelvin scale, water boils at 373. Now notice, I didn't say degrees. We don't use the term degrees with the Kelvin scale. We just say the number, 373, or whatever. Water freezes on the Fahrenheit scale at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. At 0 degrees on the Celsius scale and on the Kelvin scale, it freezes at 273. Now notice, water exists over a range of 180 units as a liquid on the Fahrenheit scale. On the Celsius scale, it exists as a liquid over 100 unit range. And on the Kelvin scale, it exists as a liquid over a range of 100 units. Now, what does this mean? Well, this means that a unit on the Celsius scale and a unit on the Kelvin scale are the same size. But a unit on the Celsius scale is a lot bigger than the unit on the Fahrenheit scale. It takes 180 units on the Fahrenheit scale to represent whatever it takes on the Celsius scale. Or, if you will, it takes 1.8 units on the Fahrenheit scale to represent the change of 1 unit in temperature on the Celsius scale or the Kelvin scale. Interesting. So 1 unit Celsius is equal to 1 unit Kelvin. And Kelvin, to convert it's so easy. To find Kelvin, just take degrees Celsius and add 273. The only difference is the starting point. To take Kelvin and find Celsius, just subtract 273 units from Kelvin, and you get Celsius. Just that easy. Now, Fahrenheit is a little more interesting to convert to Celsius. You notice that 100 units Celsius is equal to 180 units on the Fahrenheit scale. And you also notice that the Fahrenheit scale starts at 32 and the Celsius starts at 0. So we have to make provisions to change the size of the units as well as the starting point. And the formula that I'm going to give you to do that is this. Degrees Fahrenheit minus 32 is equal to 9/5 degrees Celsius. If you don't like using that 9/5 and you want to, you can use 1.8 instead. But that's up to you. But you could use 1.8. All right, let's try a problem. Here we go. We're going to convert 39 degrees Celsius to degrees Fahrenheit. Well, the first thing we're going to do is write our formula. Degrees Fahrenheit minus 32 is equal to 9/5 degrees Celsius. Let's make a little bit of an algebra change. We want to solve for degrees Fahrenheit. So let's say that degrees Fahrenheit then is equal to 9/5 degrees Celsius plus 32. Or 1.8 times degrees Celsius, if you'd rather, plus 32. Then degrees Fahrenheit is equal to 9/5 of 39 plus 32. So take your 39, multiply it by 9, divide it by 5, and you'll find that degrees Fahrenheit is going to equal 70.2 plus 32, which means then that degrees Fahrenheit is going to equal 102.2 degrees Fahrenheit. That would be 39 degrees Celsius. Now, I've got too many significant figures there, so I'm going to round it off. And we'll just say that degrees Fahrenheit is 102 degrees Fahrenheit. Do you get the idea? You might need to. You need for me to slow down for a minute and let you write, don't you? Okay, I'm going to stop for a minute. Are you ready to go to the next one? Let's give it a try the other way. Remember, don't forget to round that off if you need to. Now let's convert 39 degrees Fahrenheit to degrees Celsius. Degrees Fahrenheit minus 32 is 9/5 degrees Celsius, or 1.8 if you'd rather have it. Well, we're looking for degrees Celsius, so let's turn this around and write it this way. And say 9/5 degrees Celsius is equal to degrees Fahrenheit minus 32. Now, I've got that 9/5 degrees Celsius, or 1.8 degrees Celsius, if you'd rather, equal to degrees Fahrenheit minus 32. I've got to get rid of that from over there, so I'm going to divide by it. So degrees Celsius, then, is equal to 5/9 degrees, parentheses, Fahrenheit minus 32. You have to subtract the 32 from Fahrenheit before you multiply it by something. Otherwise, you're going to not change your scale to the right starting point. Degrees Celsius is equal to 5/9 times 39 minus 32. Degrees Celsius is equal to 5/9 times 7. 5 times 7 is 35, divided by 9. And you'll find that degrees Celsius is 3.9. Now, I'll stop for a minute and let you catch up with me. Get it down. Make sure you can do these. Okay. Are you ready to move on? Now, we said that temperature was not a measure of heat. But what is heat? Well, heat is energy that can be transferred. And something you have to remember is that energy, or the heat, is always transferred from a hotter body to a colder body. It's the hotter body, I don't care how little it is, that gives off heat to the colder body, no matter how large it is. And remember, the units of heat are joules, calories, and BTUs. Okay, folks, hold on that thought to a later date. We will cover that in a different unit. In this unit, we talked about some terms that we needed to be familiar with, a lot of terms. We talked about matter and energy and measurements. We talked about significant figures. We talked a little bit about problem solving. Yes. And we talked about temperature. Ah. Chemistry. A better way to teach and learn chemistry.